is obviously one that's at the center of Judaism, which is quite ironic because it's often not talked about. Many of the things are talked about in contemporary Judaism, from Israel to the Holocaust to halachic practices to Jewish identity to assimilation and intermarriage, but God sort of remains in the background. I suspect that one of the reasons that God remains in the background is that people have difficulty talking about God. God seems often, in the language of modern literature, distant, absent, unattainable, silent, especially in the wake of cataclysmic events like the Holocaust. Nonetheless, it remains a central obligation of every Jewish person to quest for God, seek for God as best that he or she can. I think that looking for God in the modern day is somewhat of a different enterprise than it might have been at one time. And what I mean by that is that God was, in religious parlance, some sort of taken for granted in pre-modern Jewry. I don't know if people thought consciously about belief in God, but it was assumed. And it was assumed as a basis for halachic practice. It's no longer an assumption of people that the community in which they live is going to be a God-believing or God-fearing community. One writer described the 19th century as one which embodied the disappearance of God. So it's our goal, our task, to try and look at what this issue really means, how it can help us become better Jews. To do that, we're going to analyze a variety of sources from different places, and we're going to begin with the statement which explodes at us in chapter 20 of Exodus, Parakhaf of Sefer Shemot, and that's the opening of the Ten Commandments. And it says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeititcha me'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beit avadim. I am the Eternal, your God, who has brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of servitude, or the house of servants, literally. Here, God introduces himself to the Jewish people, in a sense. Prior to that, he's had conversations with Moshe the prophet. But here is his entrance on stage to the Jewish people. It's very noteworthy how God presents. God presents not as an abstract creator God, not as a God of science or cosmology, but a God of relationship. It says, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, the house of slaves. In other words, the primary definition that God gives of himself is of a liberator. A liberator who has taken you out in the past, and the implication is will help you again in the future. I think this is enormously important because I think that many Jewish people today do not relate to God as liberation, as freedom. They, in fact, experience God as restriction, as constriction, as punishment, as something to flee from. Over the course of the time we spend together, we're going to try and better understand why we've developed that attitude. It's noteworthy. I've mentioned this before, that there was one Shabbat I was walking with my son. This is several years ago when I lived in a different place than I do now, and we passed by a church on our walk to synagogue, and it was the custom of that church to put a little inspirational phrases outside on a kind of board outside the church, and this one said, Jesus is your friend. And my son noted to me that we would have no parallel phrase in Judaism. We would have nothing that we could say of that kind, right? Synagogues do not put up signs outside their locations saying things like, God is your friend. Certainly not, Moses is your friend, right? So on the one hand, there seems to be, I think, a certain amount of skepticism that Jews have of this kind of thing. What do you mean Jesus is my friend? On the other hand, I think there's actually a kind of secret envy, perhaps. I would like to feel, goes this envy, that the divine would be so close to me, would embrace me, would liberate me. So somewhere the message of Exodus 20 got lost, that if belief in God is predicated in the idea that God can liberate us, why don't we feel that way? So that's something that we want to go ahead and explore. The question on this verse that we just read is whether it is actually constituted of a commandment at all. This formed a discussion in the Middle Ages, and we're going to begin with a comment that was made by Chasdai Kreskes, who was a Jewish philosopher of the 14th century, in his work Or Hashem. And he writes the following, and it's actually quite instructive. He says, the person who includes among the list of mitzvot belief in the existence of God falls into a common error. The very character of the term mitzvah indicates by definition that it can only apply to matters governed by free will and choice. But faith in the existence of God is one of those things which are not governed by free will and choice. Consequently, commandment can't apply to it. Well, what can you say about believing in God? How can you be commanded to believe in something? Is this really a legislative matter? So the Abravanel, who was, of course, the famous commentary, lived in Spain in the 15th century until he was kicked out along with the rest of the Jews in 1492, advances a similar view and says the phrase, "I am the Lord your God," is not a commandment. It's not dogmatic. It's not practical. It's a preface to all the other commandments. So this is very important. And it goes right to the heart of what's going on in modern Judaism. The Abravanel is saying, very simply, how can you do all of those other mitzvot which are going to follow, which, as we know, are the prohibitions against idolatry, blasphemy, keeping of Shabbat, honoring parents, prohibitions against murder and adultery and theft and bearing false witness and coveting? How can you do any of these things if you don't believe in God? So that's a very interesting point, because there are many people who can carry on a practical religious life without necessarily having a belief system. They just do it through habit. They haven't actually reflected on whether they believe in God or not at all. So it appears that the Abravanel's amazement, his incredulity at the idea that you could actually keep a Jewish life without thinking about God, turns out that people can, or at least they think they can. But for the Abravanel, the first statement in what we call the Ten Commandments isn't really a commandment at all. It's really something to tell you that without this being solid in your pocket, the rest of it isn't going to make any sense. Why do we do what we do as Jews, is another way of putting this. Have we thought about the construction of our belief system? Are we the kind of people who either get up in the morning and habitually do commandments, or are we the reverse, the kind of people who get up in the morning and habitually don't do commandments, but all the time avoiding the issue of God? So for these two medieval scholars, the idea was that belief in God is a kind of domain outside of commandment because it's not something that can be legislated anyway. However, famously, the Rambam, Maimonides, who lives in the 12th century, was born in Spain, of course, moves to Egypt where he spends the second half of his life, was the person who I think in the last 2,000 years most puts God on the map. Maimonides is obsessed with God, sees God at the center of Judaism. And you know, one of the ways you can see what's important to people is how they list things in Judaism. Let's take a brief step sideways. When you look at the Chumash, the Torah, the five books of Moses, and we're told often in Judaism that there's 613 commandments there, but what we don't see is any systematic ordering of those commandments. If you told a Martian, go and open up the Bible and find for me 613 commandments, it would be a very random, haphazard kind of selective process, because it's not like the Bible opens up and says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you've got to kind of pick them, find them, collate them. The same thing happens in the Talmud, which is the other main text of Judaism, which is compiled between the 2nd and 6th centuries, 3rd and 6th centuries, where there's an enormous amount of discussion and argumentation about what is the law and where does it come from and what do we do as Jews, but there is no organized mitzvah system. It's only in the Middle Ages that people begin to figure out, you know what, if we want to teach Jews how to live, we got to get things organized here. We got to tell them this is a mitzvah and this is a mitzvah and this is a mitzvah. So then you get into a situation of, okay, let's start from blank, tabula rasa. How should I begin my mitzvah system? What should be one? What should be two? What should be three? And if you look in certain mitzvah lists of the Middle Ages, they begin chronologically from the beginning of the Torah. In other words, the first mitzvah in the Torah is be fruitful and multiply, which is a commandment that's given to Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden. Be fruitful and multiply, pru urvu. If you look in Maimonides, and you look at the way he codifies commandments, the first commandment in Maimonides is belief of God. Belief in God, followed by all sorts of other mitzvot associated with God, believing that God is one, loving God, and so on and so forth. In other words, for him, how can you talk about anything before God? And he was rigorously consistent about this his whole life. After he wrote his Book of Commandments, where he did the list of the 613, he wrote his monumental Code of Jewish Law, which is known in Hebrew as Mishneh Torah. And if you look in the very first lines of the first law in Mishneh Torah, he says it's to know that there is a fundamental being of all beings. So what he's trying to do educationally there is to say, Jewish people sometimes run out and think about other things before they think about God. In fact, if you look in the code that's most used by modern Jews, which is a book called Shulchan Aruch, which is printed in the 16th century and is written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lives in Palestine, the opening there is essentially, what do you do when you get up in the morning? In other words, you begin with the beginning of your day. So the Sefer HaChinuch begins with the first mitzvah chronologically in the Torah. The Shulchan Aruch begins with the first thing you do when you open up your day. And it's only Maimonides who steps out and says, whoa, wait a second here. You can spend your whole life worrying about what do you do first thing in the morning or what's the chronology of the Bible without recognizing that there's a fundamental principle that you've got to adhere to. Do you believe in God? Do you think about this? Or are you one of those people who thinks that that question is unanswerable and therefore I won't even bother with it? One of those throw up my hands and say, well, who could say? How can you know? It's impossible to tell. Can't be proven. So the subsequent move from that is I won't think about it. For Maimonides, that's a disaster. As you see, this is what he says in the two sources that I listed previously. He says in Sefer HaMitzvot, which is the Book of Commandments, as you see, mitzvah number one. The first mitzvah is that God commanded us to believe in the deity, that we believe there is a cause and motive force behind all existing things. This idea is expressed in the statement, I am the Lord your God. Notice what he did here. It's something very interesting. He said that there is a standing commandment in Judaism to believe in God. And what does that mean? It means to believe that there is a cause and motive force behind all existing things. And we're going to get back to that a little bit later, but that things aren't random. In other words, one of the definitions that Maimonides is giving to God belief is that it incurs in you the belief that the world itself is not just an accident. And this, I think, touches very deeply in modern thinking, sort of post-existential thinking, where there's this idea that who knows where I came from, who knows where I'm going, my life doesn't mean anything, it's all random. I can't tell you how many people I've met in my life who feel this way, deeply. It no longer is a religious issue, it's an emotional issue, where you're asking yourself, what do I live for? What's my purpose in life? Have I ever thought about it? Do I consider the meaning of life an embarrassing question or actually a central question? And Maimonides is very plain here, right? He's a no-nonsense philosopher. Let's get to it. The first thing you got to do as a Jew is believe in God. And the reason you got to believe in God is because it creates a worldview where you don't feel that your life is pointless. That's where one is leading to two. That you've got to feel that what is here, everything we have, from our own personal lives to nature to history to the cosmos, had a point, had a drive, a purpose, a direction. And if you look at the opening of what I pointed out before, his code called Mishnah Torah, in the laws of the foundations of the Torah, known as Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, he writes the following. He writes, Yesod HaYesodot V'amud HaChochmot Leida Sheyesh Sham Mitzui Rishon. It constitutes the most fundamental of fundamentals and the pillar of all science is to know there's a first cause, which brings into existence all existing things and that all that exists on heaven and earth and between them exists only through the truth of his existence. What's he adding here that we did not see earlier in the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Commandments? First of all, the language is more scientific. It's also almost propositional philosophy. You got to say to yourself, it's a fundamental, the pillar of all sciences, to know, leida. Notice the shift in language. In the Sefer HaMitzvot, in the Book of Commandments, he said, ha'emanat ha'alokut, belief in the deity. In the Mishnah Torah, he says, the knowledge of God. What's the difference between belief and knowledge? It's not an easy question to answer. I think most of us have a sense that belief is something a little more flimsy, a little more speculative, and knowledge is something a little more scientific, a little bit more technical. In fact, if you look in, we'll take another little side trip, if you look in Plato, in the Republic, there's a very famous philosophical idea there called the simile of the line, which is Plato's theory of knowledge. And Plato's theories of knowledge, talks about what constitutes real knowledge and what constitutes lesser knowledge, and he begins with what's called conjecture, guessing. And he moves his way up to belief, which is second, and then understanding, and then pure reason. And so belief is underneath knowledge. It's not as good. Belief for Plato is when you know something, but you can't actually analyze it from the inside out. In other words, you see a horse, and you say, oh, that's a horse. So most people would say, I know that's a horse. But Plato would say, no, you believe that's a horse. Because to know that something is a horse means you have to know all of its constituent elements. You have to know, in other words, you have to know its chromosomes and what makes it inside out. Only then does Plato give it the designation of knowledge. So clearly, there's a kind of division going on here. And the Rambam is kind of jockeying around with both terms, Maimonides. He's saying, on the one hand, you got to know. On the other hand, you got to believe. So what might be the difference between these two terms? And people should think about, how do I think about God? Knowledge in the Bible is the verb that's used for sexuality. It says, Adam knew Eve. In other words, it's the word that's used when two objects fuse, and there's a kind of integration that comes out of that fusion. Belief is a word in Hebrew, emunah, that relates to a word that means craft or art, omenut. In other words, it's not a science. There's a certain amount of creativity, a certain amount of interpretation that takes place there. Maimonides wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wants people to develop faith, and he also wants people to develop a sense of knowledge. Why? Why not one or the other? It seems to me that the variation is there to say to people, at a certain level in religious life, there's going to be things you don't know. There's going to be a finiteness of your intellect. So if you think you're going to be able to scientifically prove God, that may not be in the cards, although people try and do that today. In fact, it's fascinating to me. People make a lot of money out of creating systems and codes for knowing God. And I suspect that's because deep in the heart of every postmodern person is embedded this idea that science is right. So for religion, to convince one, it has to play on scientific turf. So we'll start using scientific terminology. We won't talk about faith in God anymore, because faith became a dirty word. Because faith in the scientific era became a flimsy word, like, it's meaningless. It's very lightweight. You got to know stuff. You got to have 1 and 1 equals 2. We got to be able to chart it and measure it, and then we'll believe in it. So what religion started doing is it started applying kind of scientific notions to faith issues. So you have codes that produce stuff about the Bible, and you have all sorts of seminars that try and show that God and the Big Bang are co-equal, and I don't have anything against these things. I'm just pointing out that there's a shift that's taken place in the way we educate people about God, and it's a shift that I think ultimately will have negative consequences, because people will start to pressure religion into making a case for God that will have kind of scientific, technological credibility. And of course, when it doesn't show up quite as well as, you know, certain scientific theories, people will be disappointed. So the Rambam is jockeying back and forth between faith, or you could also say emunah is trust in God, and knowledge of God. In other words, work hard to try and see God in the world. He would call that knowledge, looking at nature. And you see the design of nature. The Rambam wouldn't call that belief. He would call that knowledge, that you're getting a certain clue here about the divine in the world. But at the same time, recognize that abstract knowledge is not the same as emotional faith. Emotional faith is when God makes a difference to you. You can, quote-unquote, know God. You can, quote-unquote, buy into the scientific seminar. You can have it intellectually proven, and it can make not a whit of difference to your life. I will illustrate by a story. I've told the story before. The very first year that I went to teach high school, entered the lion's den, as it were, I was maybe a week into teaching, and we were teaching a text, the Sefer Bamidbar, the Book of Numbers. It was perfectly obvious to me that the students were bored. Afterwards, we'll discuss what's going on in Jewish education, but in any case, and it occurred to me, you know, they don't really like this material. They're not taking the material that seriously. What's going on here? So I decided, in my Maundian fashion, let's get right to it. I asked them all, do you believe in God? There's 28 people in the room. And in almost a kind of Pavlovian response, you know, we don't want to waste all those tens of thousands of dollars of tuition fees. We don't want to make everybody look bad, so everybody put up their hand, yes, I believe in God. Kids were about 15 years old. So I said to one girl, what does that mean to you? And she said, what do you mean by the question? So I said, well, it's like this. Do you have a best friend? And she said, yes, I do. And I said, let's say one day people go around trashing your friend, saying terrible things about her. Would you stand up and defend her? Yes, she said. Would you make sure that people don't treat your friend that way again? Yes. And is that because you believe in your friend? And she said, yes. And I said, in other words, your belief instantly translates into life action, daily life action. She said, yes. I said, how many people believe in God this way? 3 people put up their hand. So I lost 25 hands in 60 seconds. Right? And that was really the beginning of my education in Jewish education. I wouldn't say the beginning, but it was a central point in my education as a Jewish educator. In other words, the discourse of God is phony. There's a phony discourse going on about belief in God, certainly in the Jewish community, and I suspect in a lot of other communities. But it's interesting that Christians at least give the impression that the belief in God is somehow making a difference to their life, at least in the evangelical community. Whereas Jews, it almost feels more like an opinion poll for many people. You know, the kind of thing you fill out on the street and you completely forget about 30 seconds later. So for Rambam, it's not just an issue of, do you technically check off, yes, I believe in God, yes, I have a mortgage, but hey, does it matter? Right, because remember that the first thing he wanted to say in Sefer HaMitzvot is that you should then, it should have implication for the idea that your life has purpose, has direction. Right? So that's also extremely important. Okay, I'm going to pass over the next page and take a look at one of my favorite books, which is the dictionary. Okay, both Hebrew and English dictionaries. And we want to take a look at some of the language that we saw in this commandment of, or at least the first commandment of the Ten about God taking them out of Mitzrayim. What does the word Mitzrayim mean? If you see here in the dictionary, it comes from the word tsar, which means both distress and also narrowness, a narrow path, a strait, S-T-R-A-I-T, right, a boundary. So a Mitzar is an oppressor, a constrictor, something that boxes you in. So you see, in Hebrew, the sentence really reads beautifully. I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of, stop. When you move into the English, it's Egypt, meaningless. It doesn't mean anything in Egypt. But if you stick with the Hebrew, I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the land of constriction, out of the land of narrowness, out of the box called your life. There is a fundamental challenge. I'm going to be perfectly blunt. There is a fundamental challenge that this verse poses to modern people, which is that the implication is you live in a box. I don't care if you don't think you live in a box, but you do. In other words, from the Bible's point of view, if you reject God in your life, if you say, I live in a life without God, you are living in a cage. It is only with the idea that there is a force that transcends one, and is actually higher than one's own concerns, superior to one's intellect, and ultimately eternal. And the attachment to that force that one is literally lifted out like a magnet out of one's finite, mortal, precarious, random existence into something higher, deeper, and more permanent. That is the import of that first verse of the Ten Commandments. It's a bomb, basically. It's a bomb that blows up and says, this is your life. You can reject what we're saying, but the rejection of what we are saying is actually going to lead you 20, 30, 40 years down the line to existential despair. Moderns are very good at denying this verse. I don't need God. It's not important. It doesn't play a role in my life. I have lots of things. Some of those things are terrific. I have a good family. I got a nice house. I got good friends. I got good entertainments. I got good distractions. But it's interesting that this verse is very rigorous. It's very tough. And it's saying, I do not care. that will not be enough for a successful life. You need to be liberated. And the fact that you don't realize that you are imprisoned is part of the problem. Or as Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav used to say, there are people from whom God is hidden, and there's a second category of people from whom the idea that God is hidden from them. And that's really where this verse takes us, which leads us to a verb in English which comes from the Latin called transcendence. We say that God is transcendent. What does that mean? So if you look in the Latin, it comes from the word transcendere, which means to pass over or go beyond a physical obstacle or limit, to climb or get over the top of a wall or a mountain. That's transcendence. It's the idea that there are obstacles in one's life, there are things which are impossible to surpass without the help of a liberating God. There's a very interesting line in Graham Greene, who's a favorite of mine, right, the British novelist. And Graham Greene, one of the characters in one of the novels, says that when we come to the end of human things, that's when we begin with God. In other words, this notion that people only take you so far. They can take you very far. Nothing wrong with people. People are made in the image of God. People are wonderful. But there are limits to people. There's a certain, if you want to know the philosophy of Judaism on one foot, there's a certain space inside of a human being that it cannot be satisfied. And I'm talking about a permanent space that cannot be satisfied by human things, that yearns for, needs, reaches for something larger and higher. And when we deny the existence of the spiritual in our life, we still feel the pain of that space. And what we try and do is fill it with other stuff. In fact, that's one of the central metaphors of modernity. We fill space. We fill it with food. We fill it with TV. We fill it with sex. We fill it with drugs. We fill it. There's a certain emptiness. And we try and fill that emptiness as best we can. And again, the mitzvah of belief in God is trying to educate the human being that you are fighting the wrong war. You are filling it with the wrong things. That spiritual spaces can't be filled by physical things. Right? In fact, this is not just a Jewish belief. There's a wonderful Buddhist scholar, a man named Stephen Batchelor, in a book that changed my life called Alone with Others, which was published about 25 years ago by the Grove Press, in which in the first chapter, Mr. Batchelor points out very clearly that modern people fill spaces with physical things and it's a bad match. Can't work. It's the wrong things to fill the space. And that was always a Jewish belief. The question then arises, let's summarize. We're making an argument here that the Bible, the Torah, Judaism, is arguing that belief in God is first, that it is a necessary precondition to a successful existence, that is the liberation of one's narrowness. It comes the obvious question, which, by the way, I ask every day of my life when I'm thinking, but I still don't know how to believe in God. It's too distant. It's too abstract. I just don't understand. You know, sometimes people talk about it like it's a kind of gift that I just don't got. You know, it's like great hockey players or great artists. I just don't know how to draw that way. I just can't skate that way. I just can't believe that way. It evades me. It's beyond me. So here I think there are more practical ways, more scaled down ways of trying to address the issue. So let's take a look at a piece by one of the best writers of religion in the world, a man named Peter Berger, who's a Protestant. In his book, A Far Glory, which came out in 1992. And I want us to pay attention to what Professor Berger says about the nature of faith, because I think it'll have direct relevance to what we're talking about. If you look on the left column, he says, faith enters on two levels. The first level is what I like to call the problem of the morning after. Even if an angel appeared to me last night, and even if that visitation was the most absolutely real thing that has ever happened to me, things may look very different to me this morning. I get up, I brush my teeth, I have breakfast, I talk to my family, I read the morning paper, And with each of these actions, the memory of last night's angel begins to fade as the power of the everyday asserts itself. Could it be that I was dreaming, that I imagined the whole thing? Faith at this point means faith in my own experience. Fundamental point about belief, which is that people's experience and expectation of belief is romantic. It's ecstatic, right? It's poeticized. We generally think that it's going to be, I got it, like art. I just got a wave of inspiration and I'm going to whiff, you know, go through a great novel now and I'm going to write the best poem. And what happens, of course, is that even if, hypothetically, let's call the bluff and say, God appeared to me in my living room, there are all sorts of problems here. In other words, it's a tremendous catch-22. Everybody says, well, you know, I believe in God if God actually showed himself. Okay, so one day you get a knock at the door. I'm here. Don't know what God would sound like. I've always felt somehow God would sound like James Earl Jones, but I recognize that that's just a prejudice, you know. Somebody said, you're having an out-of-body experience. You're having this incredible spiritual high. It seems like God is in my life. But then it's gone. It's over. So what are the options? Either God has to visit every day, all the time, for me to reinforce my own experience. And essentially, the narrative of the Torah on one level is precisely what happens when people fall into the trap of needing God 24 hours a day and actually have not built up a system that we would call faith. In other words, the Bible is a record of failure, which it really is. The Torah is a narrative of failure. The Jews experience, according to the text, enormous revelation. Plagues raining down on Egypt, splitting of the Red Sea, the coming to Sinai, the hearing of these commandments. So all of the stuff that every human being throughout history has dreamed of, right? The ultimate of the ultimate. And 90 days later, they construct the golden calf. It all collapses. It all goes flat. He's not here anymore. What happened? Maybe it never happened. Or maybe it's not trustworthy. Says Professor Berger, it's not faith in God that's the issue here. It's faith in your own experience. Do you know what you know? Do you believe what you believe? If something has happened to you, which is an act of grace, an act of faith, you survived something, illness, or you got through depression, or you made it back financially, or you're just alive to see the birds, anything. Does that translate? Does that reverberate into faith? Do you have faith in that experience? Or are we caught in the old religious cliche of, open up the sky, show me God, I'll believe. Because frankly, Judaism thinks that's a myth. If that's the thing that everybody looks for, if that's why you've come here, it's a myth. It doesn't work like that. Faith in the Jewish sense is a grinding experience. It's mucking. Day by day by day. Piece by piece by piece. It's the reinforcement of one's own daily experience and the connection of that experience to God, to saying, all of it is divine, but not the big sound and light show. Because as you know, switching back to the art metaphor, art is mostly not inspiration either. It's mostly lots of work. One should read the letters of Gustave Flaubert to see how much he had to toil over Madame Bovary to turn it into a novel. It's a good actual analogy for religious experience. It will not come at once. And even if it does come at once, it goes. And then what happens? The reason we know this is true is because we see it in our own lives on other levels. The difference between fleeting chance, perhaps ecstatic physical experience, sexual experience, and the more permanent, more complex, and ultimately more rewarding notion of a long-term relationship, which is not the stuff of waking up every day and having the clouds opening. So we know instinctively that there's a major difference between a kind of sound and light show and a real faith. So faith in our own experience. Secondly, says Professor Berger, the second level is the act by which I decide that the transcendent reality I perceived is not only there, but there for me. Faith here is faith in the ultimate benignness of the universe. the feeling of personalizing it. Not just that good things happen, but good things happen to me. Not that just life is benevolent, but my life is benevolent. Because it's very difficult, and I certainly have no judgment of anybody in this regard. It's very difficult to establish belief in God from an abstract point of view. One has to believe that that God is there for oneself. Not in a narcissistic way, but in a relationship way. Not just, I believe there's a kind of thing or concept called God out there, but that there's no relation to me. It won't work. So it has to be faith in my ability to actually believe in what happens to me, and faith that it's there actually for me. So that's an enormous emotional struggle. See, I often feel that issues of belief in God are intimately connected to one's belief system, period. Does one believe? Is one a believer? There is a lovely little story by Isaac Bashevis Singer, which in the Yiddish was called Gimple Tum, translated in English as Gimple the Fool. And it's a fascinating story. Why? Because in Gimple the Fool, he really is a fool, seemingly, by modern standards. The village people love to make fun of him by telling him outlandish tales. You know, the cow jumped over the moon kind of tales. And he believes all of them. But slowly you realize in the story that Gimple is self-conscious of all of it. He understands in a way that he might be taken for a fool. He even understands that some of the stuff he's being told might be complete falsehood. Probably is falsehood. And he has two reactions to this. The first one is, who does it hurt? So I believe it. So what? But the second one is actually profound. He says, I'm willing to risk believing in this nonsense because I'm afraid that if I stop believing in this stuff, my very personality as a believer will be eroded. And next thing you know, as he says near the end of the story, my belief in the Holy One, blessed be he, will be gone too. In other words, he's talking about the idea that you have to cultivate an attitude of trust in life. Do we trust things? This is a culture of enormous distrust. Right? In Israel, one of the worst things you can be, quote-unquote, is a friar, a sucker, somebody who gets taken in, somebody who's gullible, somebody who isn't sharp. You didn't take me today. I'm on the ball in business and with people, and I didn't laugh at the joke that wasn't funny, and I didn't believe the speech that wasn't true, and I didn't have faith in the idea that wasn't credible, and we pride ourselves this way. But in a sense, what the Torah says is you're priding yourself right into a corner. Because on a certain level, there has to be a kind of relinquishing of that cynicism into a world, not necessarily of blind idealism, but of a certain contingent trust, I would call it. For the moment, let's try it out. For the moment, let's see what we have here. Let's see what we have here in this new person that I just met. Let's see what we have here in this new book I'm reading, in this new idea I heard. Let's see what we have here in terms of a new me. And ultimately, let's see what we have here in terms of a God. There has to be a kind of trusting reality that we inhabit to make it work. So, let's move forward. I'm just going to leave time for questions in just a moment. And I want you to move forward a few pages until we reach Sartre, which says Jean-Paul Sartre at the top. Jean-Paul Sartre, an essay simply on God, was, as you know, one of the seminal thinkers of existentialism in the 20th century. A self-defined atheist. Now, briefly, the credo of existentialism, right, which was maybe the most influential school of philosophy in the middle of the 20th century, and even if one doesn't walk around calling oneself an existentialist, it's true that as a trickle-down, many people think this way without knowing it. The credo of existentialism was existence precedes essence. What does this mean? You have to understand this phrase in relation to its inverse. Essence precedes existence. Essence precedes existence is the fundamental idea of most theology. In other words, an essential meaning to life precedes my coming into the world, my existence. There is a set of meanings there, a value system, an idea, a purpose, a direction. I don't make that. It's there before me. And my job in life, my goal in a sense, is to see whether I can fit in with that worldview, whether I can accomplish those tasks, right? Traditionally, a Jew would fully understand the idea of essence precedes existence. I'm born into a world in which my task in life is there. Serve God, do commandments, love my fellow man, take care of the earth, live and die nobly, believe in the afterlife, and so on. Sartre flips it over on his head and says, no, we believe in existence precedes essence. In other words, there's no meaning to life at all as a given. There's nothing there. As the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard once said, I stick my finger into existence, I pull it out, it smells of nothing. Right? That's the root sort of quasi-nihilism of existentialism, which is there's nothing there. So what is life? What you make it. It's all self-constructed. Existence precedes essence. In other words, I come into the world, my existence comes first, and I make the essence of things. I make life. It's enormously liberating. It's also very pressuring. Because if there's nothing there, and I got to make it all the time. And I think that many modern people feel this way. Many people I know feel this way, and it's actually deeply depressing to them on some level. It's experienced, I think, as a kind of inchoate weight. It's always there, kind of, in the back of the neck and in the heart. That every day I just got to keep it up. Keep feeling buoyant. Not just keep the money coming, keep everything coming. Keep the meaning coming, keep my sense of optimism coming, keep my feeling that this is all for something coming, and it's all on us. So on the one hand, what did this liberation from essence achieve? Well, it achieved a certain kind of feeling that I'm no longer oppressed by the old gods. I don't have to do what they tell me. But the price we have paid for this is enormous. Enormous. The sense that everything in this world is on me, including my salvation, is a tremendous price to pay. Now look at how honest Sartre is. Let's pay attention to this